your eyes up, don't get all tied up, hoping you wise up. The multiple lies of the multifaceted, multi-complex system of living that people are living. Stuck in inertia, that's a diversion. Government worship, instead we are searching. Ancient mysteries, ancient history, sacred energy, and how to discern it. Human autonomy, truth of philosophy, ufology, human psychopathy, super anomalies, human ecology, you got lobotomies up in your consciousness. All the thoughts that we've been dancing around, the system wants to blow your candle out, but we won't let it. We reject it with our pathetic lies, so we chant it down.
Welcome back to Chant It Down. I'm your host, Loomis. ChantItDownRadio.com is the website. This is episode 227, or 007, Deocculting James Bond. And this is actually part 16 of the Tell Lie Vision Visions mini-series, where we talk about media mind manipulation and all the things that come with it. I actually debated on whether I wanted to make this part of this mini-series or not, but it does have to do with it, so I said, well, why not? Now, this is an episode that's kind of unique in that I got a request over a year ago from a listener to rank all the James Bond movies in order of worst to best, and it was a strange request for the show, so I put it off. I sent him that list of my own, because I have seen all the movies, and I couldn't do that as a show, so I held it off and kept this on the back burner, and I thought maybe I can do this as a half of a show, or put it on the end of a show somewhere, but it just never fits. So then I thought, I know there's some occult aspects to these movies, so maybe I'll break down those things, and then it'll be a real show. So here it is, actually probably about 2 years later, but better late than never, here it is. And if you've been enjoying the show, I got a lot of new listeners. This is sort of an offbeat show today, but my mini-series span many different subjects, and I recommend you go into the series of shows page on ChantItDownRadio.com to get more acquainted with the process on how I cover subject matter. But today is part of the Tell Lie Vision Vision series, which is where we deal with media mind control, manipulation, and all that film. We talk about a lot of stuff. So if you like the show and you'd like to support the show or just help me out, put out a 5-star review. It helps the algorithms, more people find the show. You can always do the usual things like go ahead and join Patreon if you like, $2 a month, support Afterthoughts, or just, you know, spread the word, donate, buy an album, buy a t-shirt. Those kind of things help out a small show that, you know, has on its 10th year, but barely off the ground. So if you'd like to do that, great. But yes, so I'm going to do some great shows coming up soon. Had a different month than I thought, so that's why I put out this show. And you just never really know what's going to hit you. And so I like to keep it random. I think a lot of people like the assortment of different things on this show. So I hope you enjoy this Deocculting James Bond. So this episode might be a bit specialized in a way that if you watch James Bond movies or not. So I suppose it's not for everybody, but it wouldn't hurt to touch up on some movies, or if you've never seen them before, start watching them. I mean, you might enjoy them actually, and you may not. You may not like them that much or care that much. I don't know. So your care factor depends on if you have watched those movies and enjoyed them. And trust me, I would have loved to have played some, like, you know, samples of James Bond, but you really can't find anything online without paying money. I'm not going to pay money to do that. So anyway, here we are with that. But I like James Bond movies personally. I used to watch the Bond marathons on TV as a kid, and I always enjoyed it for simple entertainment. I mean, there's an innocent piece of me in my childhood to be a secret agent before I knew who the bad guys really were and how this world really worked. And it was fun entertainment as a young boy. It was fun. Fun, innocent entertainment. And so I'm not here to ruin that simple entertainment aspect for you today, you know. And I think we as truth speakers get so rejecting of everything that we start seeing, we start being unfun people, kind of, you know. Even if our entertainment world is run by dark occultists, it doesn't mean that we still can't enjoy movies and music. And really, if it wasn't for these things, our lives would even be more dull. So I guess you just kind of have to just know that dark people have put this out and many things out, but it doesn't mean that it has to be something you dwell on. You just know, hey, you know, make your own, let your own imagination take over and try not to get, you know, manipulated. And of course, I recognize it for what it is, distraction and manipulation. But once you put that aside, you can still enjoy things. James Bond is the most iconic ongoing series of movies probably to ever exist. They've gone through a lot of actors, a lot of time periods, and a lot of ups and downs. It's kind of an interesting time capsule to see how these movies have taken on the influences of time and things that were going on in those times. And when you look at influences of the time, you see old propagandas that mean nothing now and how silly it looks. So that's something, if you do go ahead and do a James Bond marathon, watch all the movies if you like, it's going to take some time. It's like, it's kind of cool to be able to go and think that the things that people are thinking about now is going to look silly and stupid too. So it's just propaganda. When you have hindsight, when you look back and you see this, you just go, wow. But, so that's a general thing you can do with really any time you watch movies of different time periods, which I recommend, and I always recommend that. I think you can have fun with any James Bond movie. Some are not so great, but they still have central Bond themes you can count on. So, you know, you always got those boxes that they check, you know. It's a Bond movie, so you get those things you can rely on. So first I'm going to go over the occult aspects of Bond, then I'll rank them in order of my least favorite to favorite as the origin of this episode started a long time ago. So you have to be kind of into James Bond to like this episode, but it's never too late, you know. For me, Bond movies are a rainy day kind of thing, or if I had the flu in the past or was kind of bedridden or something where I'm down for a few days, it's always nice to watch a few, you know. I think the best way to go about this is to start from the concept that Ian Fleming wrote and who he was as a person. Then we'll kind of go in order of the films as far as little things I've noticed. And I'm sure someone who's been in the mystery schools could tear them apart in a way more numerology and things that I can miss. Someone who's got a better eye for the occult. In fact, some guests I've had on this show could probably do a lot of that better than me, you know, because I'm not one that really has ever really dove into the cult. I just know simple symbolisms and stuff, but I know that I'm seeing some, that's for sure. And there are a ton of sun symbolisms, pyramids, and eyes throughout many of the credit sequences, and there's too many to name, and the credit sequences are always kind of a thing you watch. They're not just something you usually skip over in a James Bond movie. The credit sequences is where they often flex their occult gang signs. That's where you really kind of you really get bombarded by a lot of things if you watch, you know. There's always so much stuff like falling from the sky and these sequences and, like, you know, little things appearing here and there. And if you know what you're looking for, you can really identify it. But let's talk about Ian Fleming, who started it, who was the writer of James Bond. And, well, he had a wide range of books he pulled from. He was at least interested in the occult, and I wouldn't doubt if he was a dark occultist himself. But where he got it from, James Bond has taken at least some of it from John Dee. And John Dee was the magician for Queen Elizabeth I during the late 1500s, as well as this guy was a teacher, an astrologer, an astronomer, and an alchemist, and he was a spy for the crown. He used a scrying mirror to contact spirits. As, you know, it's been said by me and others too that, you know, these phones we have today are kind of like scrying mirrors, these black mirrors, you know. But anyway, he did that, and he created the 007 theme. The O's in the 007, the O's were his eyes on the queen. They represented his eyes on the queen. The 7 represented the lucky number of the alchemist. So, just grabbing from that source is weird and would take someone interested in the occult to make that your central thing, I would think, you know? As well as being a spy for the queen, a spy for the evil British Empire, wanting to uphold the monarchy, the blue bloods, is as brainwashed as it gets, really. Anybody who wants to uphold, you know, the evil cabal, right? But, so, the early jobs that Ian Fleming had he was a sub-editor and journalist for Reuters, and he was in the British Navy, and he had a home in Jamaica where he wrote novels called, his home he called Golden Eye, which I think there's probably more to that. A lot of eye stuff and symbolism in James Bond, period. He also wrote Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, which is about this magical car, and but it's got some strange traces of ritual abuse if you have the eye to see, and it's definitely a weird kind of movie that seems innocent on the surface, but you gotta understand where the story comes from. So William Donovan, was an important part of the British government, asked Fleming to write a memo to outline a planned American Secret Service, and much of his wording was used when the OSS, which is the Office of Strategic Services, which later became the CIA, much of his wording was used when that was created, and thus Fleming influenced subsequent American intelligence efforts. Fleming was in the Secret Service. You know, he was himself an agent. And he took out Crowley, Aleister Crowley, who also was in the British Secret Service. And, you know, there's some weird, you know, I don't know if they were friends exactly, but basically, it's really, like, it's really weird how all this ties in, you know. Maxwell Knight was a British spymaster, naturalist, and broadcaster, and he was reputedly a model for the James Bond character M. He played major roles in surveillance and early British fascist party, as well as the main communist party. So Maxwell Knight, or M. Knight, possibly the filmmaker M. Knight Solomon is based his name on this character with the wordplay on it. I don't know, but just comes to mind, right? But this is where you get M from, as James Bond's, you know, commander in chief. So Fleming was into the occult and in the Secret Service, and which I've explained many times on this show, the two meet at the top somewhere. I mean, in America, the CIA, Satanism, and Hollywood all share the same beds together. Same with MI6 and MI5, I'm assuming, as well. So, you know, it all kind of ties in at the top, and that's where you get crazy characters like Crowley And so Fleming was one of those too. You can't see a Bond film. Another aspect of Bond films is you can't see a Bond film without seeing the name Broccoli on the credits. The Broccoli family. Kind of a funny last name, but they're Italians, I think. The Broccoli family were the producers of Bond. They were actually American, but they worked in British studios. It was Albert Cubby Broccoli, nicknamed Cubby. There's a little dirt on him. Some say he beat to death the producer of The Three Stooges named Ted Healy. And the source alleged the actor Wallace Beery, Broccoli, and a film producer, Pat DiCicco, beat Healy so badly that he fell into a coma and died. Sounds like some mafia shit, like some Italian mafia shit. And I believe that's kind of what these guys were. And at the beginning of the 50s, Broccoli moved once more, this time to London, where the British government provided subsidies to film productions made in the UK. Just that alone, you know that if the government is providing subsidies to, you know, film productions, then you have to follow what they are telling you to do. So they provided subsidies to film productions made in the UK with British casts and crews. Together with Irving Allen, Broccoli formed Warwick Films, which made a prolific and successful series of films for Columbia Pictures, And then he partnered with Harry Salzman and formed Eon Productions. Now, are you talking about the Ion of Horus with Eon? Or I don't know. I kind of tried to research that, but, you know, we are in the age of Horus, according to Crowley, and so, you know, it's very possible that Eon is a play on the word Ion. So now you have the background of James Bond. You have the background to... It didn't just come from, like, some simple novelist that, you know, was completely innocent. This is all dipped into the occult and Secret Service. So brought to you by those strands. All Bond movies have their similar characteristics. You got M, the leader of intelligence. You got Q, the quartermaster or guy with all the gadgets. Moneypenny, the secretary. Usually a nice car somewhere. Hot women, you know. And sometimes a little help from his friend from the CIA, Felix Leiter. All right. There's also some ridiculous sexual names for girls like Pussy Galore or Dr. Goodhead. Or Xenia on a top, or Octopussy, you know, it's all, there's always some funny names like that, you know. And there's usually a villain that's got some scheme or another. You have the over-the-top movies, and then you have the more grounded movies. So I'm not going to go through every single episode and reveal every detail. That would be a whole mini-series of shows, and I don't think we need a whole series of shows for this. I just, you know, that's not where I want to spend my time. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to go through each actor's tenure as Bond and look at some of the things I see here and just sort of kind of go down the list here. So starting with Sean Connery, who I think might be the best Bond. He started the character, he owned it. I mean, what can you say? He definitely owned it. And for the first three or four films, he was into his character. I think he grew tired of it after that. You can kind of tell. But during the theme of his movies, there's the continuation of this secret organization known as Spectre, and who uses the octopus as their logo, and they all wear the rings with the octopus. What a perfect symbol for the system and the elite, you know, the octopus. That's the idea that I came up with, or basically came to mind when I was trying to explain the system tentacles to you guys, you know, way back in 2013. And then, of course, I've had the podcaster and author on, Charlie Robinson, who has a book called The Octopus of Global Control, and we talked about that together on episode, maybe it was 208 or something, 214, that's right. So if you have not checked out that, you can, you know, check that out. But it's very symbolic of having control over every aspect of our lives. The octopus and its tentacles, you know, it's got its tentacles in everything, you know. And the thing we need to define from the start is Bond would be an agent of Spectre in real life. If he's serving the Queen, then he's serving the Cabal. And one thing they do in many movies is they make you look at the government and authority figures as the heroes. But they got it twisted here, as if MI6 is the hero and not part of the Dark Elite's henchmen, but indeed they are. Definitely they are. So Spectre is representative of the Dark Elites that rule our lives, and they meet in secret in roundtable meetings. They plot terrorism, they plot how to rule things, they plot, you know, they conspire. And the villain behind Spectre is Ernst Stavro Blofeld, who is bald in Betrayal many times, and he's representing Aleister Crowley. And actually, it is true that a couple of the villains in James Bond, Ian Fleming had in mind as representing Aleister Crowley, which is very interesting. It's almost like giving, instead of like thinking of him as a villain, he's sort of like, you know, giving a salute to him almost, right? But before Ernst Stavro Blofeld shows his face, he's hidden for four films. He's known as Number One, petting his white cat. And of course, that's where you get the iconic bad guy. You get the influence for Austin Powers and Dr. Claw and Inspector Gadget, you know, Dr. Evil, right? And Austin Powers. So that's where you get that. But this is, you know, trying to be serious, you know, very iconic. The question I think about is, and this guy is known as Number One, so could there be a real Number One? Could there be an actual head to the Committee of 300? Or does it even go E.T.? I know that sounds, for some of you, maybe crazy, but not really, you know? They sure don't act human, and there could be some type of, who knows, Anunnaki, reptilian, who knows, on top, or hybrid, or a group. Of course, some say that, and we don't really know, but it's interesting to think that there could be actually a head of all this. But then I also think there's different heads of the Hydra. Some maybe different factions separate on the top, and I think that that's kind of how it goes, and they even war against each other. You know, you have the Vatican, you have the Jewish bankers, you have the different families that of royalty that may not all get along, but they all have one world government in mind. But anyway, maybe there is a Number One who is human, one that heads the secret of secret meetings, who knows? But I think when people get exposed to things like James Bond movies, they hear about the world being run by a secretive force, and they think it's like Spectre, and they think we are outlandish for thinking such a thing. You know, I saw that in a movie, you know, and they get the cartoon version of it in their mind, and they write it off. In reality, it's exactly how it works, though. Roundtable meetings like the Bilderbergers or the CFR or the Trilaterals or the Club of Rome or, you know, many of these groups, but they are just simplifying with Spectre, where in real life it would be a little harder to explain than just that, right? But that's what they're saying. Now, Spectre, just to go off on a tangent for a minute, means something unpleasant that might happen in the future, Spectre. And it stands for something. It's an acronym. It stands for Special Executive for Counterintelligence, Terrorism, Revenge, and Extortion. Fleming didn't actually invent Spectre. It was a screenwriter named Kevin McClory. And later there was a lawsuit, so Bond producers couldn't use Spectre for 40 years, so that's why it disappeared after the Connery movies. There was some lawsuits, and I don't want to get into it, but it's a long story. But anyway, so it didn't exactly come from Fleming, but it is kind of true that it is like true to life as a representation of our leaders. But we can also go off on this. We can also trace it to Uri Geller channeling the Nine, which I've covered on the show. That's where we get Star Trek and the Galactic Federation. You know, that's where Gene Roddenberry went and, you know, got ideas for some of his shows. And you know, and so I guess Uri Geller broke off on his own, but this is in 1971, and he determined that there was an AI computer orbiting around known as Spectra with an A at the end, but it's very close to Spectre. So you got to wonder if this was already known about, and possibly this is being used. Who knows, right? But when I have Freeman on this show, the second time. I think it was episode 70, and I did do a replay of it for more recent viewing or listening on Retro Relevance. But Freeman brought up on this show years back, another aspect of Project Bluebeam is to channel entities into our soul using fiber optics, or Wi-Fi, and all of the dark names for our computers. So with HP, you got Omen, and Spectre, and Victus, you know, and Mac with its bitten out apple, you know, I mean, the forbidden fruit, right? So it's all interesting how we are kind of like channeling things through the internet, even we don't realize it. So that's why I've always looked at the internet as a double-edged sword, you know? It's like, yeah, there's good things, like I'm doing this on the internet, right? But then there's a lot of bad things, too. But so back to the Bond movies. So as we get through the Connery Bond movies, we get to investigate it as he does. We start out with Dr. No, and he's chasing a mysterious villain called Dr. No, who tells Bond that he's part of Spectre. And then in the follow-up to that, From Russia with Love, he continues to find out that he's dealing with this group. And we also find out that the Russians are also being duped by this same group. And again, it just sort of shows you that Spectre is above countries, and that these elites are even fooling the leaders of countries. They're fooling everybody. So really, it's the shadow government, you know, and it makes a lot of sense. And I'm not sure how true to life this is with our actual presidents and prime ministers. I mean, they are selected, so they may know more than they let on, but not really sure, you know, exactly. But as far as it goes, there is a force. I mean, if you think Biden is running America, you got to be joking, right? But by the time we get to the fifth movie in the franchise, which is You Only Live Twice, so you had, just to go over, you had Dr. No, From Russia with Love, Goldfinger, Thunderball, and then You Only Live Twice. The Spectre has the ultimate scheme of stealing everyone's space shuttles launching into space. And as over the top as it is, it's this kind of theme that government desensitizes people, that a group above government could have schemes this large to take over the world, you know? But the truth is, yes. I mean, the volcano lair for Spectre, it seems ludicrous, but in actuality, the elites have hollowed out mountains for bases as well as underground bases and stuff for forever. So that's, it's just that they're just telling you, you know, in plain sight, if you know what to look for. As over the top as this fifth movie was, it was, you know, the set pieces were huge, and it was quite the movie, you know. We finally get to see number one, Ernst Stavro Blofeld, and he's bald and all scarred up, and I think he's representing Crowley. And so the continuity through these movies after this is pretty sloppy, unfortunately. You know, we don't even get the same actor playing Blofeld, and it's like they didn't give a shit on a lot of this stuff. So when we get past the tenure of Sean Connery, we get one movie by, standalone movie by George Lazenby, who took on the role in Her Majesty's Secret Service. And he meets Blofeld on a ski resort mountaintop, but somehow Blofeld doesn't recognize him. So, like, again, it just, like, it doesn't even make sense. And there's a lot of things that don't really make sense. So you don't take these things too serious. But, yeah, George Lazenby as James Bond was one of those things that was like, hurry up, get a replacement. And, you know, I'll talk about it more when I rank these movies, but it's just that I think he would have been a good Bond. He had the physicality, he had the look, and I think that it could have worked out if he had done more movies. But in retrospect, more people are liking this movie than when it first came out. We'll talk about that in the rankings. But what this episode is, again, on Her Majesty's Secret Service, Blofeld has a large group of women who are there on a retreat on this mountaintop ski resort kind of thing. And at night, in their sleep, they get programmed by these tapes into their subconscious to carry out a terrorist plot. And it just shows some of the elite's techniques they do to possibly their own agents to carry out things like false flag attacks. And I wouldn't doubt it. It's kind of just showing their techniques because, as we know, they do this kind of stuff, this MK Ultra. They do this. They've been doing this kind of stuff. And one more thing about on Her Majesty's Secret Service is his James Bond takes on a wife in this movie. So it's kind of a different Bond in that he has more of a soft side, finally falls in love. The maiden name of his wife is Draco, which also means dragon, or you could look at the Draco constellation. So, you know, pointing to that, which always makes you think about, you know, kind of some of the ET theories within the elites too, which is quite possible. So it's kind of a nod to that, if you know what I mean. Teresa Draco. So then we get Sean Connery back in one of the worst Bond films of all time. So I guess he was offered a lot of money to come back. Nobody liked the George Lazenby movie. It just really didn't have a good response. So they brought in Diamonds Are Forever. And I'll talk about how awful it was later. But one thing in it, Bond has a chase scene through a facility of some sort and bursts into like a film set where they're actually filming the moon landing. And I found it as a nod to the fact that they showed us a movie set when showing us that the moon landing that we saw. On this show, we believe they went to the moon, but they didn't show us that bit. And the secret space program was really who went to the moon, and they didn't want to show us the real technology that they were using, so they may have filmed parts in a studio somewhere, or even the whole thing. Who knows exactly, but I think that's what they're trying to say. And it's just such a random, thing. Like, why would they go through the process of even showing us? You know, here you got James Bond running for his life from in some facility, and suddenly bursts into a moon landing set. It's just, and then he takes a moon vehicle and drives it out of there, drives it through the wall. It's just giving us a little, here you go, this is what they're doing to you if you want to know, you know. And there's also a Bill Templar mentioned in the movie. Now, Templar, Knights Templar, Bill could also be known as Ball, possibly, you know, just something I noticed. But yeah, so that's Diamonds Are Forever, and it was horrible. This is where the series kind of goes to shit for a while, if you ask me. There's a slew of movies that are not that good. And honestly, I think it's the time period of the early 70s. They were putting out some weird films at this time. It's like, I don't know. It's like everyone was coming off of their acid trips or of the late 60s or making weird ideas that show today as a total experiment on society that had taken place to even come up with the weird ideas in film then. It was just like if you watch some early 70s movies, you're like, where are people's heads at exactly? This is just weird. And it just shows you that an experiment on society had taken place. And, you know, to your average citizen all the way up into the film studios, everybody was kind of a little bit off their rocker, you know, and that all led to some, you know, interesting turn of events that has, you know, raised generations differently and divided society. And we've all talked about this, but anyway, just, you can see this era in film at this particular time, not just Bond movies. So we went into, after Connery's Diamonds Are Forever, we went into the Roger Moore era. And the most campiest of James Bond films probably is the Roger Moore era. I actually liked Roger Moore when he came into his own Bond. I kind of liked him, you know. And I have a theory about Bond movies, too. Whoever you first saw as Bond is going to either be your favorite, or at least you will have nostalgia for that person. In the case of Roger Moore, I have nostalgia for him. He's not my favorite, but he was Bond when I was a little kid, so I always kind of liked some of these movies. And I'll tell you about that on the rankings. So some of his movies are fun to me, for me. His first movie is part of that weird era of movies, though, which is Live and Let Die. And suddenly we're getting subjected to... And this is when the world was kind of coming out of that more innocent stage of television and movies. And we get it subjected to more occult things like tarot cards and voodoo and like in Live and Let Die, the symbol of the fish and bait company is the Aurora Boris, the symbol of the snake eating its own tail. So you can kind of see this stuff. And what a weird blaxploitation film and this movie was, Live and Let Die. I'll talk about that more in the rankings too. And then in The Man with the Golden Gun, a weird villain with three nipples. I mean, is there an occult meaning behind that? I don't know. I have no idea, but it's just odd. It's just weird. And the villain himself, Christopher Lee, was a known occultist. He was into the occult, and later movies played people you might know, such as Count Dooku in Star Wars, and in the Lord of the Rings movie, he was the evil wizard. I forget his name offhand, but so anyway, that was a strange thing. During the Moore tenure, you get to see villains like Drax in Moonraker. And notice the name Drax, the name Drago, referring to the Draco constellation or dragon again. So, you know, you see little things like that. But see, the Moore era drifted away from Spectre, and I'm sure there's some symbolism in all these films, but they couldn't even use Spectre because of a lawsuit, so... And they used Roger Moore way too long. He was like 58 in his last movie. He did seven 007 movies. But I think he should have retired at like 5 movies and called it good. But they used him too long. And those last two movies of his are not too good. But so we get through that era when that was the 70s and mid-80s by the time he got done with his tenure of Bond. He was Bond the longest and in the most movies. And then we get into the Timothy Dalton movies. And this was a big change up. He only made 2. And honestly, I think he was one of the best Bonds. You know, I think he's so underrated. And he played a more realistic Bond. One that was a real killer if he needed to be. The only thing he lacked was his humor. He was almost a little too dry. But that didn't really bother me that much, because it was very refreshing coming off the back of those more campy, movies. And I think his movies were decent, and they were ahead of their time. And it's a shame they didn't get more movies out of him, actually. Even if the movies are really 80s feeling, they worked for me. Of course, I grew up in the 80s, but it doesn't matter, because I think they're solid films. And in these movies, you know, you only get 2 from him. No, The Living Daylights was the first one he made, and notice how the good guys are siding with the Afghanis in the Russian-Afghan War, and that's during the time when the CIA and probably MI6 too were supplying weapons to Afghanistan and creating the Al-Qaeda, the Taliban. And then as time goes on, suddenly the Afghanis are the enemy. So notice how propaganda works like that, you know. Because that's during the tail end of the Cold War right there. And then we get License to Kill, and that touches on the smuggling of cocaine into the U.S. through Florida, and which was exactly what was happening at the time, as well as when the crack epidemic was flooding the U.S. inner cities at the time by the CIA and other intelligence. So you get little truth bits, you know, when you look back at these films. So only 2 films by Timothy Dalton, and then we get into the Pierce Brosnan era, probably my least favorite Bond. To his credit, he had crappy scripts, mostly, you know, except for his first one. He just had crappy scripts, and he did embody all the good characteristics of the previous Bonds in one. I mean, he looked the part. You know, he could take on the Connery kind of feeling, and the more silliness of the Roger Moore, and the more seriousness of Timothy Dalton. So he kind of, but when he spoke, it just wasn't the right voice or something. It just didn't work for me. And what I didn't like about him, he was too refined. He was too perfect. He never got it wrong, and it just kind of felt like, I don't know, just, you know, you can watch those and see what you think, but his first movie, GoldenEye, was a solid film, and that's a reference to where Fleming wrote his novels. His house he called GoldenEye in Jamaica, and you gotta wonder what occult type of thing that's pointing at there, because indeed he wasn't into the occult. So what does GoldenEye mean? Yes, in the movie it's a I don't know if it's like a kind of like a computer chip. It's a weapon system, but Golden Eye, you know, you got to wonder, is that the eye of Ra or the eye of Horus? You know, you got to wonder if it's something dating to that ancient Hermeticism. You know, I think someone else could probably answer that for me more. But there's a lot of titles involving gold. There's Gold Finger, Man with a Golden Gun, and Golden Eye. So there's a lot of gold symbolism in James Bond in general, and gold goes back to pretty much the beginning of humanity. If we're going to go to the Sumerian texts and talk about gold, I mean, gold is used, the Ark of the Covenant was gold, and we just covered that on the last episode. So yeah, gold is you know, always been important to people. But anyway, that's a tangent. In these Brosnan movies, Bond went to the extreme reliance on gadgets. And one film that stands out here, though, is Tomorrow Never Dies. And it's symbolic of how the media actually works. So they're giving us a look at how it really works. Here's the synopsis. So media mogul Elliot Carver wants his news empire to reach every country on the globe, but the Chinese government will not allow him to broadcast there. Carver doesn't take no for an answer and plans to use his media empire to fuel flames of war between the Western world and China. Thankfully, James Bond is onto the insane news tycoon and travels to China to stop him with the help of Chinese secret agent Wai Lin. So that's the synopsis, but you know, using the media, basically it shows you how the media can get the reaction of the people and fuel the flames of people and nations and wars and all that. It's not that great of a movie, but again, it's about what they are inserting here. And it is interesting to look at, especially once 2020 hit, you can really see how the media does work that way. Now, so I stopped watching James Bond, pretty much in the early 90s till like 2012. I never watched Pierce Brosnan movies, so I went back and saw those. And I was during my teenage years, I was busy hanging out with friends, doing music, chasing women, just being, you know, not really watching a lot of movies too much. I mean, some, yes, but not like, I don't know, just I kind of fell out of, it was more of a kid thing for me. But what happened is I saw Skyfall in theaters in 2012, and that piqued my interest in Bond again. I was like, oh, a Bond movie can do this? Actually, this is pretty good. So I missed Daniel Craig's entry to Bond. And by the way, when I walked out of the theaters to see them spraying our skies with chemtrails that day, and I said to myself, well, here's the real Skyfall, and that's where I got the idea, actually, for my mini series of shows, The Real Skyfall. So I do remember though. See, I was having kids at this time when James Bond was, or Daniel Craig became Bond, and I remember seeing that there was going to be a blonde James Bond, and I was thinking, oh, that's going to be dumb, so I didn't care. And turned out that Daniel Craig might be about the best Bond. I can't say better than Sean Connery, but on par. I mean, he was good. And this is what Bond needed. It needed a reboot at this point. It needed a re
configuration of things in order to carry on from where Brosnan left it. And he's the most, Daniel Craig's the most realistic Bond, and how an agent who gets into tough situations should be, you know, ruthless, badass. He even shunned his authority, didn't listen to his own boss. He bled. He was more reckless, and this made it more entertaining. He was flawed, and that's why I didn't like Brosnan as Bond, because he was too perfect. And it also showed why he has a chip on his shoulder with women, rather than just a misogynist guy who hooks up with hot women. In Casino Royale, Vesper burned him, and the one he gave his heart out to, then he gets burned. So, you know, I'd want a few martinis after that too. You know, it was harsh, and it kind of showed how Bond shaped his characteristics. It also reinvented Bond. Ever since Sean Connery, they tried to get a guy that looked like him with the same hair color, just kind of had that look. Where here, they just decided to start from scratch, and it actually worked really good. And I guess these movies, these Daniel Craig movies, loosely connect. Going back, I guess I should say that even those others loosely connect. All the other movies tell Daniel Craig, they loosely connect where the Daniel Craig movies connect. But the thing is, in For Your Eyes Only with Roger Moore, going back a bit, he visits the grave of his wife from Her Majesty's Secret Service, which is, you know, when he actually took on a wife. So it connects that as a real event. And then later in License to Kill, they mention how he lost his wife. But they did a poor job of trying to connect all these films. But Daniel Craig's version is a universe of its own. It doesn't connect to any of that at all, in fact. And even though they do carry over the same actress as M, which is Judi Dench, other than that, it's completely just like a whole new universe. So Casino Royale opens with Bond becoming a 00 agent. And I guess it requires two kills. And it makes you wonder if that's a real requirement in some secret order somewhere. You need two kills. It possibly could be, right? I don't know. But it just makes you wonder. And later in the movie, because Bond's kind of reckless and does his own thing, doesn't obey authority, he gets chipped. He actually gets a RFID chip put in him. And, you know, again, kind of just entering that in our minds, desensitizing. It's okay to, you know, get technology inside you. The main bad guy in Casino Royale, his name is Le Chiffre, and he was originally supposed to be Crowley. And this, by the way, Casino Royale is the first James Bond novel. They did it a couple of movies back in the 50s and 60s that weren't part of the official James Bond movies. And I guess they sucked. I never saw them. But this is taking the novel and taking it seriously. So this is the original meanings behind things. And so, yes, Crowley, or Le Chiffre, is supposed to be Crowley. But what I like about it is this villain, Le Chiffre, is being pressured by his organization, and he fears for his life. So you have that side of it too, where he's not really in control. He's just trying to be in control of the situation that he's in. And it just shows you the elites have uppers behind them, and he's more of an asset rather than top of the chain. And so these string of movies with Daniel Craig start tracking a secret organization that eventually becomes Spectre. So they brought back Spectre this time. And I hope I'm not, you know, if you've never seen these movies, it's okay. I don't think I'm spoiling it too much. But so they did. They brought back Spectre. But and at times they did a lousy version of connecting all these films with this secret organization, I found. But it brought modern-day situations to the table, such as in Quantum of Solace, the second entry for Daniel Craig. We find that this group meets at an opera and talks in headphones to each other, So you don't, you know, you don't know that they're talking to each other unless you get the special headphone. And meanwhile, there's a play going on stage with a big, all-seeing eye behind the actors, and it's like a ritual. And when action pops off and Bond gets shot at and he's shooting people and beating people up, and it becomes a chase scene interwoven with scenes of that ritual on stage, so they can't keep panning back and forth. It sort of reminds me of how the elite always have a drill while the real false flag is happening. That's just what came to mind. But yeah, there's a lot of ritualistic kind of like stuff going on that stage. If you watch and you're less concerned with what Bond's doing, you know, check that out. In this movie, which, by the way, is one of the most hated James Bond movies, and for some reason, I'm finding it that kind of suspect that I don't think people are seeing what I'm seeing here. But the main villain, Mr. Green, he has a foundation to save the Earth called Green Planet. And it's this organization, they're all green, and, you know, they're doing their best. He gets applause. Everybody applauds him after his speeches. But really what he's doing is he's buying up land and water rights in Latin American countries mainly and controlling their resources. Exactly what the elites do, just like Confessions of an Economic Hitman. Same sort of thing. And these countries are suffering from drought, and it's being blamed on global warming. So really, green is hiding all the water, but the population thinks it's global warming. That kind of sounds familiar, right? And he is just a branch of this organization, which they call Quantum in this movie, because the creators hadn't yet won back the rights of Spectre from that other writer, Kevin McClory, I talked about. But they obviously won it back later. But so I think there's a lot to actually breach out of that movie, even though it got low ratings for a Bond film. I thought it was better than most people would think it is, and maybe because I'm seeing what they're putting in there. So then you get Skyfall, and again, that's where my James Bond renewal came about in 2012. I was like, wow. So I thought it was a pretty good film. Now, there's some things in there, and it's kind of like the British government is trying to say that there's no need for 00 agents anymore because there's no group in the shadows. And yet there really is. And it reminds me of people who won't subscribe to a shadow government on the basis of never seeing it before because they watch mainstream TV. But again, we have to remember that the group in the shadows includes all secret agents, all MI6, CIA, and you know, all the Mossad and all this all over, and it's all part of it. In Skyfall, when M is writing Bond's obituary, look at how half of Bond's face is showing, and it's again showing that one eye symbolism. You know, they got to do that. Show the left hand path. You know, and in the movie Spectre. So now we get to Spectre, the fourth movie in the Daniel Craig tenure. We get to see this group in action, making plans around a round table. So now we have a modern day iteration of Spectre. It exactly where I might imagine these groups meet, you know, in Rome, bloodlines in the Vatican in Europe, you know, that kind of thing. And so we see them planning bombings. We see them planning these things. And then later on, we see them carried out and planning everything that comes on the news. So if you watch Spectre for this reason, it makes so much sense. Also in that movie, Bond gets injected with smart blood. So he gets injected with this smart blood that goes through his system so he can be tracked. So again, he's what happened to the RFID chip? Isn't that enough back a few movies ago? So he's injected with this smart blood substance. And to me, it... Now looking back, it reminds me of maybe like graphene oxide. This movie, I found, had a lot of occult things in the very beginning. If you watch the beginning of Spectre, you go through the Torch of Columbia, and then you go through the Eye of the MGM Lion. Both this movie and Skyfall are full of one-eye symbolism in the credits too, by the way. And then in No Time to Die, when we get to the fifth and last James Bond movie up to this date, we have a virus that kills off certain programmed people by using their DNA. It's called Project Hercules. It's a programmable DNA targeting nanobot weapon. You know, does that not sound like stuff I talk about on this show concerning chemtrails, Morgellons, nanobots, the vaccine? I mean, it certainly does, doesn't it? And so I almost wonder if, you know, they had a lot of time between Spectre and this movie. It had a bunch of rewrites. It went through a lot of problems. It took years for them to finally release it in 2021. And you almost wonder if they just didn't want to release it during 2020 during all this because they, I don't know, like didn't even want to feed us conspiracy theorists. I don't know. But the villain's name in this is Lucifer Saffin. Lucifer spelled L-Y-U-T-S-I-F-E-R. Lucifer, but they say Lucifer. I mean, you know, here we are. Dark occultism right there staring you in the face. I was afraid this movie was going to be woke, but it wasn't that bad. It wasn't that woke, so I was kind of happy with it. But overall, they were a great set of Bond films, in my opinion, and I'll go over that in the rankings in a little bit here. But all in all, again, they're showing us Spectre to the modern day, and they did a decent job at it. Just again showing you the secret organization and how they rule the world. So that's, I mean, I didn't go through each film. Like I said, I didn't want to do that, but there are 25 Bond films to date, and that was the 25th. So what's in the future for these movies? I don't know. So these are all the Bond movies to now. What they do pass here is scary to me, I'd say. I've heard they want to make a gay or bi Bond. I mean, who mostly goes to see these movies? Let's see, straight guys. I'd say even more than women, definitely. Guys that kind of like action. You know, there's a certain fan base here. And I would say very few are gay. And so what will that happen? That'll wipe out their audience. Go woke, go broke. You know, that's the saying goes. So if they're going to do that, you know, or maybe they'll do a trans Bond. I mean, scary, you know? I mean, it's just scary what... I have faith in no movie franchises at this point. In 2023, I have faith in none of them because you're going to see something. And with the occultists having always had Bond in their hands, you're going to see something that you're probably not going to want to see as they just come out in the open with all this now. But here's some advice. Not that they're listening, but do the character he was written to be. Flawed in everything. Let him be a womanizer. That's just who he is. You know, that's Bond. People go to see that. And they say they want a black Bond. Okay, but make it a black Bond because your best candidate is black, not just to force it for a diversity hire, you know? And that's what they sort of did with the last one. His replacement was a black girl. And she took on the number 007. And, you know, maybe people don't want different. Maybe they want to see the exact character they always wanted to see. And if you want to get detailed, I mean, really, Britain's Indian population is huge. If Bond wasn't white, he'd probably be Indian. So it would be more realistic to make him the next Bond an Indian guy rather than a black guy, to be honest, like using statistics as far as like largest population there besides whites. So, I mean, I don't know. It could get scary with the next Bond because if they want to make it woke, you know, but yeah, anyway. So that's where the movies stand at this point. Well, let's get into my ranking of the movies here. Let's take a quick break. right, well, that's as close as I can get you to some suspenseful action music, but there you go. And now we get into the point in the podcast where some of you may tune out, and that's fine, or you may not care. This is one of the rare podcasts I make where you'd have to be interested in this specific subject to care. And this is not chanting it down. This is just my ranking of all the 007s. And it's a matter of if you have seen them all, and it's a matter of if you are interested in that. And if you are, I recommend you, I would just say buy a box set. That's what I have, is I got a box set. Let me see, it was like a Blu-ray box set I got years back. So I've seen them all. Not recently, but I've seen them all. And so these movies are a formula, and it's great to see how many ways they are stretched, but still stay inside the formula. After all these years of making these movies, they still feel like Bond movies, you know? And so that's what's great. There are many boxes to check to make a Bond movie. And so they got, you know, they always have these certain things they do, the villain, the Bond girl, but most or not all feel like a Bond movie. I'm not ranking them on the basis of, oh, the villain wasn't so good in this one, or no, purely on my enjoyment. Some movies are more nostalgic to me than others, and I'll talk about that too. My list is not your list. No two lists are the same. If I watch them all again, I might switch them around slightly, you know, and it's very subjective. I'm basing these purely on viewing pleasure. So these are the 25 James Bond canon movies. There are a few other things that are, like some slapstick movies are based on it. One of them, Casino Royale, that's like a 60s movie with Peter Sellers. And there's Never Say Never Again, where Sean Connery was brought back in the 80s. And he did a movie with a director who had the rights to Spectre. But it wasn't very good. It was a remake of Thunderball, which is already a movie. And it didn't have the theme music. And so I'm not putting that, just the 25 Eon production movies, which are canon. All right, starting at number 25, Die Another Day. This movie is the worst James Bond movie to me. So we're going from worst to best, and this is the worst. I don't want to watch it again. It's trash, really. A North Korean guy gets a facelift, and he's a British guy. He's the villain. It's just absurd, kind of ridiculous elements in here. Madonna's in it, and not just because she's in it does it suck, but she also sings the theme song, and that's not even why the movie sucks. It just sucks. It's mainly because the early 2000s CGI in it too that makes it worse. It's just way over the top with fighting with these lasers. You have James Bond kite surfing a tsunami with icebergs. Looks like a video game. It's pretty bad. Early 2000s CGI is not too good if you look these days, a lot of it. Pierce Brosnan, my least favorite Bond, so I rank it low anyway. But this one is pretty bad on most people's lists that I've noticed. Halle Berry's in it, and she's not too good. It's bottom of the barrel Bond, and it actually starts out like it's going to be a good movie, in fact. But the second half is so horrible that basically they had to reboot this whole franchise afterward and make the Daniel Craig era, which turned out to be a whole lot better. But yeah, Die Another Day, worst out of all of them, I think. Number 24, Diamonds Are Forever. This movie's trash. This movie's really bad. It's amazing, you know, they got Sean Connery, and, you know, he was such a good Bond, but he was brought back after George Lazenby played Bond for one movie, and he was coaxed with a lot of money, and this is that awkward time in the 1970s when they just were too experimental and weird with movies, and a lot of it doesn't hold up today, or it just looks really weird, and it's like everybody just had too much drugs, like I was saying, and just sort of, I don't know, like there was these two gay henchmen in the movie, and it was just weird. It's not because they were even gay, it just was like the what they were going for, I don't even know. Blofeld, the main villain, and so they didn't ever keep the same actor that played him, which really sucks because it the continuity of these films is terrible at this point, where they're using another actor, and so they're making the excuse that Blofeld had plastic surgery, and, you know, they even use an actor from another movie they already made, as if we wouldn't notice. The Bond girl's annoying. There's Bond's in America, and you know what? Something about a lot of the times when Bond's in America, these movies, I don't know, it's like the landscape they chose. They're in Vegas, and it's just not interesting. They need to use America's good topography in a Bond movie if they're going to use it. There is great cinematography that they could use. It's low budget. It feels like they gave all the budget to Sean Connery, and that was it. And so, yeah, it's not worth seeing. It's surprisingly really bad. Number 23, A View to a Kill. And this is Roger Moore's last outing as James Bond. And notice these are all the last movies of these actors in their tenure of Bond. Maybe they were just tired by then. But Roger Moore, in the case of being 58, well, he looks like a pedophile with the Bond girl. Well, maybe he was. I don't know. He was a Sir Roger Moore. You got to wonder. But Christopher Walken was the villain. He was wasted in such a bad movie, such a good actor in a bad movie. The movie felt cheap. It's really pretty forgettable. It almost feels like a made-for-TV movie. Not too good. The only thing good about this movie is Duran Duran's song, A View to a Kill. And that's about it. It's a pretty forgettable one. It's just they used Roger Moore way too much. Number 22, Live and Let Die. It's just weird. It's just a weird movie. It's, again, in that awkward time in the early 70s, an experimental time for movies. They were kind of riding off of blaxploitation films. They were riding off of, like, Shaft and Superfly, which are fun movies, kind of, you know, for that era, but they really didn't need to make this a Bond movie. I don't know. It was kind of crazy. I mean, notice that Bond movies will take on whatever's hot at the time, whatever's trending. And so this is what was trending. So they went ahead and did this. It shows you voodoo and occult stuff. But one of the things in it that's really annoying is there's this annoying sheriff. I can't even remember his name. From the South. And for some reason, they think he's funny. And I think where this is coming from is they're kind of bringing this from the time when the movie Deliverance was a big movie in the 70s, if you've ever seen that. So they kind of, I don't know, but it just didn't, it was dumb. It was terrible. And it's not super terrible. The whole movie's not super terrible. It's just not great. When the villain dies, you'll laugh. It's the funny, I don't know. When I showed my kids when they were little, we just all laughed. It just looks, doesn't hold up good. But anyway, it's just not a great movie, okay? Number 21, Octopussy. And then again, here's a Roger Moore in another movie. Roger Moore, still too old. It was the second to last movie. And there's, you know, it has some redeemable scenes. It's not all the way terrible. It's kind of good in some parts. But the stupid things I can't override. James Bond, he's in the jungle, grabs a vine, yells out a Tarzan yell, you know, and he's dressed like a clown and a gorilla. And it just ruins the vibe. I mean, it's like, it's trying to be, it's like, it's a mix of too much campiness and seriousness to where it doesn't work. But it has it's the first Bond ever in India, and so you got the India backdrop, but overall, not that great of a movie. Number 20, Tomorrow Never Dies. And I mentioned this, and maybe the reason to watch this one is just for the control of the media. We got this media mogul in control of the media, and so points for that, okay? But it's not that great. It's kind of forgettable. You know, it might have some good action sequences. Michelle Yeoh is kind of cool for Bond's counterpart, Chinese agent, that they, you know, go around together with, and that's okay. It's just a forgettable movie all in all. It's just once Pierce Brosnan did GoldenEye, hit all the rest of the movies that he made after that were just turned worse and worse. And that goes along with number 19. Number 19, The World Is Not Enough. You know, it's a tad bit better than Tomorrow Never Dies, but it's not great either. There's this villain. He's lost his nerves from a gunshot wound in the head, and he doesn't feel pain. But it is not used very well. And Charlie Sheen's ex-wife is a genealogist. What's her name? Denise Richards is her name. And she's just miscast. You just can't take her seriously. All she is just, you know, just Bond's playgirl, you know. That's it, you know. And it has kind of a cool twist at the end, but it was kind of just lackluster. And, you know, the Brosnan era was not my favorite, is my least favorite Bond era. But, you know, it could have been a product of these times. I mean, you know, even though I love the 90s, this is like 1999, and this is the late 90s, kind of sucked for movies and music. And also, you know, Brosnan had bad scripts, so no, not that great of a movie. Okay, going on to what I would call the mid-tier films. So everything I just mentioned are things that I don't feel like watching again. I just never really got into them, you know, they're just not the greatest ones. But now we're getting to the mid-tier movies, and these are watchable, and I'd have a watch again. So if you came to my house, you know, and you picked out any of those titles I said before, I'd be like, no, we're not watching that. But these mid-tier films, they're watchable. They're enjoyable Bond movies. And so number 18 is Man with the Golden Gun. It's a mixed bag, this one. I like the Thailand setting. Christopher Lee was an awesome villain. Has three nipples, so weird. And he has this midget henchman knickknack, and you know that all was kind of cool, and that's probably the coolest part of the whole movie. But again, it's that early 70s stupid awkward time of movies. The sheriff returns again from the Live and Let Die, and it's just no fun with him. Once he comes in the scene, they try to make him funny. It's not funny. And then they do a flip. James Bond does a flip where he goes over this ramp and the car turns upside down. I mean, it's a cool stunt. He goes back on his tires again, but they ruin it with a slide whistle, like, and it was just, like, not that cool. So, and then you'll see some ripoffs again, because this is probably around the time that Enter the Dragon, Bruce Lee's best movie, came out, and they have basically ripped off the martial arts scenes from that. So Bond copying the times is, you'll see it again and again. Besides the villain, this movie's kind of forgettable. You know, you might have a good time watching it, but it's all right. Number 17, License to Kill. This is Timothy Dalton's second, and I really like Timothy Dalton as Bond. I wish we could have seen more of him. And this movie's having a reappraisal nowadays. More people are liking this movie. It's an interesting Bond because he goes rogue, and it doesn't feel like it feels like an 80s action movie versus a Bond movie. I liked him for the reason in this movie he was pretending to be an undercover friend to the villain. And while the villain is fooled by him, it's kind of cool, but you are scared for Bond because this villain's going to eventually find out, you know, and he's got to be careful. It's a pretty good movie. It talks about cocaine smuggling, which was a real thing going on at that time for sure. Kind of an offbeat one, not my favorite, but watchable. Number 16, For Your Eyes Only. For Your Eyes Only is kind of just like right in the middle. It's a real middle tier Bond. It has some cool scenes. It has a rock climbing scene at the end that I liked. It was kind of intense. It has some cool snow chase scenes. This funny, I guess he's a henchman villain. He picks up his motorcycle and throws it at Bond. It was kind of hilarious. You know, this is a more grounded Roger Moore, and it's not either bad or great. It's just, I don't know, kind of forgettable. Like, I can't even, I couldn't tell you what really it was about that much, but it's not a terrible movie. There's this young girl that wants to sleep with Bond, and he actually refuses it because she's like 18 years old, but, you know, he's actually refusing to sleep with her. So it kind of shows he has a little respect or something. But yeah, that's For Your Eyes Only. Number 15, Moonraker. A lot of people like to trash this movie. I have nostalgia for this movie personally. This is a movie that I watched as a kid. I kind of like it. The first three quarters of the movie is good. I mean, he's investigating a villain who wants to poison the Earth and repopulate the whole Earth with his preferred genetics, which is, of course, eugenics. So it's really just boldly putting it out there, you know. Not really that bad of a movie at all, actually. I think it's enjoyable. Roger Moore is in it, and he's, you know, he's in one of his best roles. It's a decent film to me. You know, some, they copy Star Wars. Yes, they did. Star Wars came out and what was trending at the time, so they decided to make a space movie. But Jaws is in it, probably my favorite henchman. And the weird thing about this movie, and I've said this before on the show, is with this Mandela effect, there's this, I swear, growing up watching this movie, that Jaws meets a girl, and their commonality is that he has these shiny, you know, fang teeth, this whole metal mouth, and then she smiles and has braces. Well, she doesn't have braces now, and it's a really weird thing, and a lot of people are, you know, are like, what? I was sure of that, too. This movie knows what it is, and that's why it works. It knows that it's silly and campy, but it has, it just feels like it's a full product, and to me, it's a good movie. Number 14, Spectre. I liked it more when I saw it, and then later viewing, it's kind of boring a little bit. Maybe, you know, it's kind of dark. They used some kind of filter that maybe made it look, I don't know, sort of drab. And it's got some great scenes in it. There's too much to say that's good about it to throw it away. But it's not, it's my least favorite one of the Daniel Craig movies. It does a lousy job of trying to connect all the movie's villains from the Daniel Craig era. And there's no indicator of ties to this organization, especially in the movie Skyfall. And then we're supposed to believe that the villain in there, oh, he was part of this thing too. It's just too convenient. It's got good scenes in it. It's a bit long. It's not terrible. It's just a middle-tier Bond. It could have been better, that's all. Number 13, GoldenEye. To me, it's a really refreshing movie coming from a long Bond hiatus. Brosnan was at top-notch, as top-notch as he gets as Bond. You know, the plot was good. There were good choreographed scenes. It was, you know, it was really a fun ride the whole way, really. My complaint about Bond, or Brosnan's Bond, was he was just too perfect. And so it kind of just took away from that. Like, he was just too, like, you know, debonair and just too smooth. That it got to where it's like, it's a little bit unbelievable. But never mind that. It's definitely the best Pierce Brosnan movie. Number 12, Quantum of Solace. A lot of people put this at the bottom of their list as one of the worst James Bond movies. I don't think so. I actually like this movie enough. It's the things I don't like about it is, well, they try to copy Jason Bourne with that fast shaky cam. So again, copying the things that were trending at the time. They always do this. But it was done during a writer's strike. But if you have seen it and you don't like it, watch it a few more times. Watch it another, give it another shot. It'll grow on you. I liked Daniel Craig in it. He was awesome. It was a good revenge plot. He was damaged. It's a direct sequel to Casino Royale, and he was, you know, on a rampage, ruthless. And it connects so well, and it actually has a very good arc for him. You know, he finally forgives the girl from Casino Royale at the end, so it actually has a good arc. It works for me. It has a good connection to the real life scam of climate change. So for that reason, I really think it is better than most people say, like I talked about earlier. It brought you into this mysterious organization, which is later Spectre, and they should have kept this going through all the movies, so it actually has some good continuity, but they didn't. So that's why Spectre suffered, I think, because they didn't continue this mysterious organization this whole time. All right, number 11, Thunderball. Connery is great in it. Sean Connery is awesome in it. It is a classic. I like it. The thing that I don't really like about it so much is the underwater scenes drag it down a bit. It's like they had figured out how to make a underwater filming at that time, and it's like they were showing off how much they could do, but these days it won't entertain you as much. Still has enough great scenes in it. Tells you more about, you know, this Spectre organization, and you can compare it to our shadow government, so a lot of parallels you can make from it. Not a bad movie. Not my favorite Sean Connery movie, but still it's pretty good. And then number 10, On Her Majesty's Secret Service. This one has had a modern day reappraisal, and most people when it came out did not like it. Like my dad's era, you know, the people from that, they'll be like, that's not Bond. And yeah, he wasn't the greatest actor, but the plot and the cinematography is awesome. And the action scenes are really good. You know, he would have been a good Bond, George Lazenby, had he done more and polished his acting and he'd done more movies. He would have, he had it. It just like they put him in too early. The thing that bothers me every time, though, that I watch this is he breaks the fourth wall and looks at the camera and he says, this didn't happen to the other fella, and referring to Sean Connery, which ruins it because of, again, the continuity that it's the same guy. So it's like, oh, he's not really the same guy. I don't know. It's like that shouldn't be in there. It did have a strange soft side to Bond. He falls in love It just doesn't match Sean Connery how he was, so I suppose it's not good for the continuity factor, but was actually a really not a bad movie. I don't mind that movie. Number 9, You Only Live Twice. You know, some say it's not so good, but to me it's a classic. It's again one of those nostalgic movies for me, you know, when I saw it as a kid. So that has a piece of what I like in it. I don't mind the over-the-top Bonds like this one and Moonraker if they know what they are, and this movie knows what it is. The villains in the volcano lair, and this is, again, where Austin Powers movies get all their cues from this, you know. There's some stupid things in here, like trying to make James Bond blend in Japan and make him Japanese. It's not actually racist. Like, it's, you know, we chant that way of thinking down on this show because we know what real racism is, as we've talked about it before, but it's just not acceptable in these times. But who are these times to judge? We're off our rocker completely. None of my Asian friends said it rubs them the wrong way. It just kind of looks ridiculous. But they built up the first four Sean Connery movies for this big banger of finally getting to see Blofeld with his cat. You know, you get to see his face. And, you know, I'll watch it again. I like it. Number 8, No Time to Die. Now, this is the newest one. This is the 25th Bond movie. I've only seen it twice. And would it go up or down on my rankings if I saw it again? Maybe. It's not as woke as I feared, but I had a good time watching it. It has the DNA targeting nanobots in it, and that's very interesting. But as a movie, it's a little clunky as far as the plot goes, trying to tie it in with the others. And that's the greatest flaw with all the Daniel Craig movies, is they're trying to tie them all together, but they just weren't written all right to tie them all together. The ending is controversial. It didn't bother me too much, but I thought it was good. I may have to see it again sometime to see where I would actually put it, if I would move it up or down in the rankings. So right about here, now that we've done number 8, is in the series is when I think of the classics. Like, so from here down, I think of, like, these are ones that to me are classics. So number 7, Goldfinger. You know, a lot of people, this is their favorite Bond movie, and it's good. It's really good. It's a classic. It's the first quintessential Bond movie. It has all the gadgets, the cars, the quips, and it's just, it's the full package finally, right? After the first two that were, you know, still trying to figure out what it is. It has an awesome villain, Goldfinger, and his henchman, Oddjob, with his hat, chops off heads of statues. I liked that. And then the Kentucky setting was the only thing on this movie that was kind of boring. It was kind of like, I didn't like, my problem is that he was captured too many times. And when James Bond's captured, he's not real active. So he's kind of passive. And I didn't like that. And I thought Kentucky was kind of a boring setting, you know, for, they need to use better American, backgrounds if you're going to feature America, I feel like. But anyway, that's number 7. Number 6, The Living Daylights. And I rented this on VHS. So this is a personal favorite. Like, I rented this on VHS in the new release section when it came out, and it was a revitalization of James Bond. Timothy Dalton is so underrated. I thought he was excellent. I still think he is an excellent Bond. He takes it more serious, but it's just more meaningful to me. It breathed new air into this franchise after some pretty bad Roger Moore films. They use him until he was too old. So Timothy Dalton was, you know, really good in this. There's this cool chase sequence sliding down the snow on a cello case. You know, it's pretty fun. One of the coolest cars in the franchise. I like this milkman. He was throwing milk bottle bombs. You know, it was fun. And it was, you know, very 80s, but it's great for its time. My only complaint is the second half of the movie is not quite as captivating. But this is still a good movie and a very underrated Bond and very underrated movie. But I think it's one of the best. Number 5, The Spy Who Loved Me. And this is where Roger Moore came into his own. He's got the humor, the charm, the wit. This one and Moonraker are his best performances because of he had really come into his own. He goes on location to Egypt. I liked that part about it. I just did. There's a lot of great scenes in this movie. It knows what it is. The villain wants to destroy the Earth and live in his underwater city while it happens. And then you got Jaws, who's the best henchman, I think. And this is the first one with Jaws. And yeah, it's a fun movie. It's a good one. A classic. You know, they got it right finally in the 70s. Number 4, From Russia with Love. This is an excellent movie. This is a classic spy movie. It's almost like an Alfred Hitchcock thriller. It has that feeling. If you know those kind of movies, I love the train scene in it. They do a good job showing that there is an organization controlling above Russia, America, and England. And you're like, well, who is it? Well, it's Spectre. And this is a spy thriller, is what it is. And I think they should, if they're going to go with another James Bond, I think they should do this. They should bring back a Bond movie like this. Make it in the 60s. You know, don't make it modern and not woke. Of course, they will try, though, I'm sure. But great movie. One scene in it that kind of takes away from everything is there's this weird scene where they go to this gypsy camp, and it just doesn't feel like it has much to do with the movie. But a small complaint, an otherwise great film. Number three, Skyfall. Skyfall is a quality movie. It's got what brought me. This was my James Bond revival as an adult. It's like, wow, this is pretty good. The only flaw is he was a rookie in Casino Royale, and then he has the direct sequel, Quantum of Solace, and now he's washed up and old. I mean, shouldn't they have done that at the end of his five movies? You know, it's like, oh, now he's already old. I don't know. But I loved almost every scene. It's good. It shows what an agent would do for thrills when not on duty. He's at this bar drinking with a scorpion on his hand, you know, and it's like you'd need that adrenaline rush if you were someone like him, because on your time off, you probably wouldn't be able to deal with just the monotony of the regular world. That's what I got from it. But anyway, great film. Number two, Dr. No. This is the first Bond movie, and I like the simplicity. Some people don't, but I do. And it feels like a pilot to James Bond. It doesn't have the everything, you know, all in place. I like it. I like the Jamaica setting. It's a little cheesy at the bad guy's lair, but I just like this movie, and it makes me, if I want to watch a classic Bond movie, I'm probably going to put in this one, Armed from Russian with Love, just because they have a feeling that you can't get in movies anymore. Most people might not say it's the best, but I just like it, okay? And then number one, Casino Royale. This is such a great movie. It's a strong reboot on the series after the horrible Die Another Day. So it shows 007's beginning, and it shows him work his way up to the organization responsible for terrorism. I like it because he's rebellious. He doesn't follow orders. He's flawed. That's what's good about it. And he bleeds. You wouldn't think that a high-stakes poker game would be entertaining, but the way it was woven in with other scenes, it worked. And it has all the qualities of James Bond. He wears Bond so well, even if he doesn't look like all of the rest of the actors, it's like he just put a new spin on it, and it was really brilliant. And there's so many twists at the end. It keeps you going. It's my favorite one. I mean, it's hard for me to put it as number one because I like all these classics so much. I could barely, try to single out number one, but ultimately I think it's the best one. So that's it. That is all 25 of the films ranked. So this goes out to the listener who originally wanted me to do this, and happy to. It just was kind of fun for a change, not doing the gloom and doom, but much love, you guys. Chant it down. Be a warrior, not a warrior. We're gonna do a guest on the next show, and I hope you've been enjoying this run of shows for the month of April. Good stuff coming up in May, and till we meet again, be a warrior, not a warrior. Chant it down.
Chant It Down Radio's coming to you live from the Hawaiian Islands, coming from the perspective of complete freedom, coming from wisdom outside the system and then some. This is the mouthpiece of the natural earth forgotten. At this point in time, humanity's been kept from the truth, so Chant It Down Radio offers the coordinates to a path out.
You're searching for something whole, 'cause what you see, real life. You're watching this world unfold, the truth beneath the lies. Rekindling what's been stole, the need to free one's mind. Uncover the truth exposed, so people see the light. Let's chant it down, so we can know. It's simple, we just break it down a little bit, so we can process all. Make the switch and elevate yourself to conscious mode. And it's beneficial, we can get this kind of road. And get the future generators, wanna start the whole thing. With the message to this city, we can start a post. Taking in, assimilating, getting lots of numbers. Waking up the population, try to stop hypnosis.